This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Germany is in a real pickle right now. What is it going to do about Donald Trump? America's new president seems intent on letting the European Union project fall apart, and Germany in particular cannot let that happen. We're going to talk about the political pressures facing Germany right now that seem to be paving the way for the rise of a politician who can address those issues. The managing editor of thetrumpet.com is Brad McDonald. He's written an article about a man who just might be that politician. In his classic book, Democracy in America, French writer Alexis de Tocqueville made some fascinating observations about the United States. Even though this book is over 180 years old, a lot of what he wrote really resonates because of what we see happening in America today. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some of his points and compare them to statements that Donald Trump made in his inaugural address, see what we can learn from this classic book. Do you want to know how unusual and unpredictable the world is today? Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques has an interesting way to tell. Just look at what various dictionaries have chosen as their word of the year for 2016. We'll talk with him about this unusual lens through which to view today's world events. And I'll conclude the program with some words about why at times it is important to deprive your children. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. What is Donald Trump thinking? This is a question on the minds and lips of leaders all over the world. And this is especially true in Europe, since President Trump seems to want the European Union to fall apart. As we've brought out, this could destroy Germany. So the question of how Germany responds to what's happening in the United States is a very important question. And we want to talk about this and about an individual who may have the answers that Germans are seeking right now. For this, we have via Skype from our office in the UK, Mr. Brad McDonald. Hello, Brad.
How are you?
Oh, doing great. Thanks for coming on. Let's start by just briefly talking about what a critical time this is for Germany. Why do Germans need to have an answer for the Trump presidency?
Sure. Well, very simply, Donald Trump is attacking the pillar issues of German stability. He's talking about imposing tariffs on German exports into the United States. That's going to have a direct impact on the German economy. Donald Trump supports the European Union disintegrating and falling apart. The European Union was created to, let's say, hem Germany in, to prevent Germany from becoming the leader of a European superstate. Donald Trump has indicated that he has tremendous affection for Vladimir Putin. Russia, and in particular Vladimir Putin, is a major concern for Germany. You go back and you look at Germany's history with Russia, and the Germans are always concerned about Russia. And Donald Trump has come along, and it looks like he's ready to empower the Kremlin. Donald Trump wants to look at NATO and reevaluate the relevance and the importance of NATO. And he's talking about initiating an American retreat from NATO. All of these institutions, NATO, the European Union, the economy, Vladimir Putin, all of these issues are absolutely integral to Germany's political, economic, and social stability.
So this puts a great deal of pressure on Germany. And of course, I believe we've written Angela Merkel's epitaph a few times on this program, but it does seem like there is going to come a point where she proves unable to meet the challenges of the day. And as these challenges mount, the pressure on her is going to increase. But you've written an article that's up on thetrumpet.com that draws attention to a man in Germany who may be able to bring some unique benefits to the table in terms of German politics. Tell us about Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg.
Sure. He really is a pretty impressive figure. I mean, even physically, he's a handsome man. He's very eloquent. his analysis and his insight when he's talking about world events, and particularly events that revolve around Germany and Europe, is just refreshingly candid and honest. He really has an interesting, let's say, political heritage. Obviously, as Germany's former defense minister, he's very well connected in Germany. There was a time when he was the most popular politician in Germany. He's very well connected to European leaders. He could pick up the phone and have access to almost any top high-level European leader. What makes Gutenberg particularly interesting is that he's also pretty well connected with American officials and some high-ranking Americans. The reason for this is because for the past 4 years, he's been living in the United States. And during his time in the United States, he's been very active writing articles for Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine. He's been on Fox News and CNBC. I mean, he's really established himself as an influential figure, even within America's media landscape. So this man, he understands Germany and the way it operates. He understands Europe and the way Europe operates. And also, really importantly, for the Donald Trump era, he understands America and he understands Washington and he understands American culture and he understands the way America operates. So it really does seem like he is ideally positioned to navigate the German-American relationship in the Donald Trump era.
Yeah, actually, you mentioned just how much he's been out there, a voice in the political realm and just analyzing what's going on in the world, talking about trends and so on. What are some of the things that he has said about Donald Trump specifically that show maybe the insight that he has that would be important at this time for Germany?
Sure. Well, he's had a lot to say about Donald Trump. What I appreciate in what he said about Trump is that it isn't just bluster. Trump is a bad guy. Trump is going to bring the world down. He's talked about how Germany needs to respond to Donald Trump and Donald Trump's foreign policy for America. He said that Germany needs to end its, quote, passive wait-and-see approach to foreign relations, meaning, okay, the Donald Trump presidency has put these key issues on the table. Germany needs to – we need to stop letting America establish the dialogue on this, and Germany needs to be more proactive on these issues. He also stated that Berlin needs to respond to Donald Trump with, quote, language that Trump understands, which is just really interesting. I mean, if you know much about Donald Trump, well, then you get a sense for what kind of language does he understand. That language, Gutenberg said, includes clear, constructive, and, if necessary, hard language or rhetoric. So I think he's a politician, and he says, well, we need to work with Donald Trump, and we can't just throw the relationship out the window. But he also says we need to play the same game as Donald Trump. We need to be tough. Germany needs to be proactive. Germany needs to be more independent. Germany needs to take more leadership. Germany needs to be more confrontational with the United States.
This is a message that seems like it really would resonate with a lot of German people right now.
Absolutely. And perhaps even more today than on Friday when we published this article, because the Europeans, like many Americans, have responded with tremendous fury toward Donald Trump and his approach to the latest executive actions to ban Muslims from certain countries. That decision just intensified the animosity that so many Europeans and especially Germans have for Donald Trump.
Which is ironic because it does seem like the tack that Donald Trump is taking with respect to immigration really has come about as a result of lessons learned from the problems that have besieged Germany and Europe more broadly, the way that they've handled immigration. And he's trying to apply those lessons in the United States, practically speaking, to prevent those similar types of attacks from happening in the U.S.
Right. And no doubt there would be a handful of Germans who would look at what he just did and they would say, oh, we need to do the same thing here in Germany. But the post-war pacifist anti-war culture in Germany really is pretty intense. It's pretty strong, and it's going to take a lot for that to be to be kind of cut away, and for Germany to eventually say, well, in some respects, Germany will have to say, well, we need to be more like Donald Trump in the United States.
Yeah, this brings an interesting point up, because it does. We've talked about just this trend happening, not just in the United States, but you see this playing out in a number of countries around the world where there's people that are kind of reaching for these bigger personalities, this populist type leaders that have the cult of personality surrounding them. What is your view of how this trend plays out in Germany in particular? Because it does seem like there have been a couple of statements that Gutenberg has made that seem to play into that desire, which when you look at German history is obviously something that's quite concerning.
Right. And I think this is one area that makes Zu Gutenberg so interesting. Zu Gutenberg, while he has really pretty severely criticized the way Trump operates, I think he at least recognizes the merits of some of Donald Trump's policies. Zu Gutenberg identifies and sees the issues, some of the issues, the same way Donald Trump does. And I think Germany is waiting for a leader who will come along and identify Germany's problem with the migrants, Germany's problem with radical Islam diluting the German culture. Right now, a lot of German leaders aren't prepared to go there. They're so politically correct, they're so liberal, they're so sophisticated that they don't talk too much like that. But what's happening in the meantime is the nation is beginning to think like that more and more. And I think Zu Gutenberg, he does view those issues as serious. And it just wouldn't surprise me if he, like Donald Trump, starts to talk about them. And when he does, I think his popularity could go through the roof. I also think that Zu Gutenberg will talk about them in a more maybe balanced or nuanced way than Donald Trump. I don't think he'll be so abrasive in the way he talks about Muslims or migrants or immigration.
Or even as abrasive as some elements within, say, the Alternative for Deutschland party and some of what's happening politically in Germany. You could see him tapping into some of that sentiment publicly without any of the stain that is associated with the more extreme parts of that party.
Exactly. I think there are millions and millions of Germans who want someone to confront the issues: radical Islam, the migrants, immigration, the economy. But they want someone to confront the issues in language that doesn't make them feel like Nazis. And the AfD, a number of AfD leaders do that. They talk in such a critical language, and it just brings to mind these images of the Nazis. And some Germans look at that and they think, that's not who I am. I don't want that. But if someone comes along who discusses the same issues and identifies the problems, but does it in a way that's balanced, that does it in a way that's eloquent, that does it in a way that will make the German people not feel bad about themselves for supporting him, then I think the Germans will just rally behind that individual. And I really think Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg could be that individual.
Now, there has been talk for quite some time. He was disgraced and sent away because of problems with his doctoral thesis. So was it 4 years ago? But there have been talk about him coming back into German politics. So he's been pretty adamant in insisting that is not going to happen. But there are signs that wall of resistance might crack somewhat. Maybe you could just tell us about talk of a Gutenberg comeback.
Sure. Well, for someone with this man's political acumen, that's exactly the response he's going to give. I think he even stated in one interview that the likelihood of his return is as likely as him breeding giraffes in his cellar. Like, it's not going to happen. But it's looking more and more likely. On Saturday, news was released in Germany that Zu Gutenberg will now campaign for the Christian Socialist Union Party in Germany ahead of elections in the fall. He's going to return to Germany regularly and be a feature speaker at large campaign rallies all across Germany. He's going to make media appearances as a promoting the cause of the Christian Socialist Union, which I think is really, really interesting. Here at the Trumpet, Mr. Gerald Flurry has said, you know, he's told us we're expecting a Daniel 8 figure to return in Germany, but he's told us repeatedly that this man isn't going to be elected. He's not going to go through the democratic process to assume control of Germany. And it's just interesting to look at the way Gutenberg is returning. He said specifically that he doesn't want to run for office because he doesn't want to, you know, deny the opportunity to another CSU politician. So he's going to come back, and basically he's going to be the face of the CSU, but he's not going to be a candidate. So he's going to be in a position where he's out there, the face of the CSU, no doubt, you know, saying a lot of things that will get a lot of Germans excited, but he won't be on the ballot, which when you look at the way we've, I mean, it really is intriguing to think that he could be in a position to where he's very, very popular, but he's not a choice at the ballot box for the German people.
You could foresee some kind of a scenario where some way or other he ends up assuming a more direct leadership responsibility without having gone right through those normal channels. And maybe just briefly, you could talk about the fact that it is the CSU. This is one of the pillar mainstream parties in Germany. There's been a lot of exodus of support away from these parties toward the more fringe parties. But you do wonder, with him coming in and say lending that political support to the CSU, if that might reverse the trend that we've been seeing politically in Germany.
Absolutely. I think there are millions and millions of Germans who right now don't have a party to identify with. Mm. They identify with some of the sentiment of the AfD party, but they can't bring themselves to join a very obviously extreme political party. But they, at the same time, they don't have a whole lot of love for the CSU right now, Angela Merkel's party, or the CDU, sorry, Angela Merkel's party. So if someone can come along in the CDU and really tap into the fear and anxiety of these people, I think there are just millions and millions of people who are ready to throw their weight behind the mainstream party that at least appears as if it's ready to address their concerns.
Fascinating picture of politics in Germany. You wonder how quickly this is all going to unfold. Elections are next fall, but a whole lot can happen over the next several months. And it seems like, especially with the pace of events unfolding as they are in America, you could see some pretty significant changes happening quite soon. We'll definitely keep our eyes on what's happening in Germany. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Brad McDonald about German politics and specifically the possibility of Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg playing a larger role there. He's written an article called Trump, Germany, and KT zu Gutenberg. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. We really appreciate your time, Brad.
My pleasure.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In his inauguration on January 20th, Donald Trump called Americans righteous. He said, "We are God's people." He said, "Americans want great schools for their children, safe neighborhoods for their families, and good jobs for themselves. These are the just and reasonable demands of a righteous public." And he quoted the Bible saying how good and how pleasant it is when God's people live together in unity. He also talked about how we'll always be protected, most importantly, protected by God. It made me wonder how many Americans actually consider themselves righteous and consider themselves God's people. And of those who consider themselves righteous, how many actually are righteous? I try to be righteous, but I'd have a hard time describing myself with that term. But as strange as that language might have sounded coming from President Trump, America actually has quite a history of our politicians praising us as if we are the repository of all that is good and virtuous in the world, whether or not it is true. There are a few of us at thetrumpet.com and the Trumpet magazine and our staff here who formed a little book club. We meet each week to discuss what we're reading. We've been plowing through recently the Hillsdale College American Heritage Reader. This is a collection of several writings that illuminate America's history. And these comments at the inaugural reminded me of some statements, some points that were made in Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. And I wanted to talk about this on today's program, so I've invited a fellow member of the book club, trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here.
Yeah, I just want to have a little mini book club meeting here, and we can give our listeners a little taste of our weekly discussions. But first, though, Andrew, you have some examples of other American presidents making similar type comments about Americans to those that Donald Trump made. Maybe you could share those with us.
Yes, obviously the tendency of presidents and leaders and politicians to praise the people who they're trying to get to vote for them is something that goes back all the way to the beginning of American history. But I've brought in at least a few examples from more recent decades. Showing how that President Dwight D. Eisenhower, when he first kicked off his presidential campaign in 1952, said that the energies, courage, endurance, and wisdom of the American people constitute a titanic force. President Jimmy Carter had said that he wanted a government to be as good as the American people are. His successor, President Ronald Reagan, had said that he said, "I have never failed when I trusted the wisdom of the American people." Bill Clinton, actually, on the day when his impeachment inquiry had just begun, had declared that "I trust the wisdom of the American people." And then even more recently, Barack Obama had said that. He said, "I know America is full of courage, optimism, and ingenuity. The America I know is decent and generous."
Yeah. So pretty common language to hear. Maybe not using the term righteous, but similar types of adoration of the virtues of the American people. What struck me was there was this point in Democracy in America, and he was talking about just how the under a king that people tend to praise the king, and let me just see if I can find this one passage. It says, "The French, under the old monarchy, held it for a maxim that the king could do no wrong, and if he did do wrong, the blame was imputed to his advisors. This notion was highly favorable to habits of obedience, and it enabled the subject to complain of the law without ceasing to love and honor the lawgiver." The Americans entertain the same opinion with respect to the majority. So basically, the majority opinion in the United States has the same kind of, it receives the same deferential treatment that a monarch receives under a monarchy. Now, maybe you can just explain a little bit about who Tocqueville was and what this book was that he wrote.
Right. Well, he definitely provided a very fascinating perspective on American society as it was developing. He was Alexis de Tocqueville was a French aristocrat born in the midst of the French Revolution. So society was changing. They'd killed the king. They'd instituted a very direct democracy without any checks and balances, where the People's Assembly voted, and you'd had just hundreds of aristocratic families being beheaded during his infancy and early childhood, and then it witnessed the rise of Napoleon. And then after the downfall of Napoleon, the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty. And so when he was in his mid to late 20s, I think about 25, he'd actually come over to America and like on a trip that lasted about a 3-year trip from 1831 to 1832, would have been during the presidency of Andrew Jackson, just to kind of give his take as a French aristocrat who'd seen some of the excesses of unrestrained democracy during the French Revolution, to see that it was obviously working out quite a bit better for the Americans. To see how this is different from what he'd witnessed during the French Revolution, how this is different from the monarchy that had just been restored in France, and then wrote this book, Democracy in America, published 1835, to summarize his findings.
So he really had kind of the approach of an anthropologist, taking notes, making observations, cataloging what worked, and recognizing problems and deficiencies as he saw it with American society. And to me, this thing that he noticed among Americans, the fact that this transference of the deference that they would have for a monarch to the majority opinion in the United States is really fascinating, because he goes into quite a lot of detail about just how much the way that people view the majority actually in some ways tends to be even more overarching and dominating of the views of the people than it is when they're under a monarch. But he talks about how much that attitude that the politicians basically pay toward the majority reflects itself in ways that are very interesting when viewed through the eyes of someone who grew up under a monarchical system and is accustomed to more of the aristocracy. And he says, it's true that American courtiers do not say sire or your majesty, a distinction without a difference. They are forever talking of the natural intelligence of the populace they serve. They do not debate the question as to which of the virtues of their master is preeminently worthy of admiration, for they assure him that he possesses all the virtues under heaven without having acquired them or without caring to acquire them. They do not give him their daughters and their wives to be raised at his pleasure to the rank of his concubines, the way that, say, a monarch would, but by sacrificing their opinions, they prostitute themselves. Moralists and philosophers in America are not obliged to conceal their opinions under the veil of allegory. But before they venture upon a harsh truth, they say, now this is like what you would, the language that you would hear from the politician, and it's very much like what you were giving to us earlier. We are aware that the people which we are addressing is too superior to all the weaknesses of human nature to lose the command of its temper for an instant. And we should not hold this language if we were not speaking to men whom their virtues and their intelligence render more worthy of freedom than all the rest of the world. The end of the quote. And then he says, it would have been impossible for the sycophants of Louis XIV to flatter more dexterously. So the same kind of deferential treatment that the courtiers around the king would give to the monarch, you hear in the language of the politicians toward the people within the United States. It's a really interesting point.
Yeah, it is a fascinating point, and it's definitely rooted deeply in human nature that if you live under a monarchy, you try to flatter the king to get what you want. If you live under an aristocracy, well, then you flatter the aristocrats. And if you live in a democracy, you flatter the people because, in particular, the majority of the people, because they are the rulers of the country. And just like a monarchy is dependent upon the character of the king, and an aristocracy is dependent upon the character of the aristocrats, a democracy is dependent on the character of the people. That's why that's at least folklore says that there was a woman who caught Benjamin Franklin as he was leaving the Constitutional Convention and was really curious. He's like, well, what type of government did you end up coming up for us? And he's like, well, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Mm-hmm. And there'd been a lot of their other letters that point that like just that like under a monarchy, you need to have a good king. If you're going to have a democratic republic, at least 51% of the people have to have the wisdom and character to run a country.
Right.
Otherwise, it will fail eventually.
Yeah, Tocqueville, he actually made the point, this is another statement he said, the majority lives in the perpetual practice of self-applause, and there are certain truths which the Americans can only learn from strangers or from experience. And of course, he's using that to justify his own coming over here and talking about these things. But that aspect of the majority and basically the people of the United States being accustomed to being praised rather than being criticized is an interesting and dangerous aspect of the political system that we have established in this country. Because if there is a politician who has bad things to say, if he's going to criticize the American people and maybe expose some of our flaws and our faults, we will punish him for that in the same way that a monarch would if there was somebody who wasn't treating him with the respect that he felt like he was due. The American people say, well, we don't want to hear that. We want the politician who thinks that we're the wisest people on earth.
Right. And that's why it is so rare. I mean, I guess if you go back all the way to the Civil War, you'd had like Abraham Lincoln, who'd called a day of fasting and prayer. And he was talking about that this war, God has allowed it to come upon us because of some of the sins we've allowed in the country. But that's very, very uncommon for a president to go give a speech about the sins of the American people. You don't win elections that way.
Right.
You more want the Donald Trump types talking about how righteous the American people are, or the Barack Obama types talking about how the America he knows is decent and generous.
Yeah. Yeah. The point that you made about and that Tocqueville makes about, say, the nature of the majority, if the people are unrighteous, he talks quite a bit about just the tyranny of the majority. And if you have the founders went a long way to try to prevent the abuses that take place under a monarchy when you have a bad king, and they limit the damage that a bad leader can do through the series of checks and balances and very narrowly defined constitutional powers given to each of the branches of government and so on. But the bottom line is, if the majority of the people are wicked, then you end up having similar type problems to what you would have if you had a bad king.
Right, and in some ways even worse, because they established a democratic republic in America because they figured, just on a probability wise, it's more likely that you'd get a bad king than it would be that 51% of the people or more would turn bad. But there is definitely historical precedent that when you do get 51% of the more of the people turned corrupt, it can be a very frightful type of tyranny, in some ways even worse than a king. And de Tocqueville had written that here too, where he says, the authority of a king is purely physical, and it controls the actions of the subject without subduing his private will. But the majority possesses a power which is physical and moral at the same time. It acts upon the will as well as upon the actions of men, and it represses not only all contest but all controversy. Just bring out this point is like some of the authoritarian monarchs of the Middle Ages. I mean, they did oppress the people physically, but they really couldn't. There were no thought police back then. Where in some ways, if you're a minority who disagrees with what the majority has decreed as moral, there's almost a moral pressure forcing you to comply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting stuff. That obviously that we've talked for about 15 minutes here. Usually when we have our book clubs, we have a hard time constraining the discussion to an hour and a half.
Right.
During over lunch once a week. But an interesting discussion. Democracy in America really is a great read. I've read portions of it before, but the excerpts that we read this time were much more about some of the problems that Tocqueville discovered. What I'd read before was much more of the favorable views that he had about it, but it really does expose some of the qualities that he saw in America. This was 170 years ago, 180 years ago, but you see those same trends playing out in America today. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about righteous Americans and democracy in America. We appreciate you coming in, Andrew.
Always a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You want to know how unusual and unpredictable the times are that we're living in? There's a pretty unusual way to tell, and that is to look at what various dictionaries and organizations that specialize in language have chosen as their word of the year for 2016. That may sound a little strange, but trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques says it's an interesting measure of what's on people's minds, how much they're struggling to make sense of everything that's happening in the world today. He's written an article on this subject called One Last Word for 2016, and he's here to talk about it. Hello, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's just go down the list here. These organizations, they all kind of have their different criteria for how to select the word of the year, but maybe you can just kind of give us a piece at a time. We'll start with dictionary.com.
Okay, sure. Yeah, dictionary.com is my go-to dictionary, the one that I use pretty often when I'm working on research and articles and things like that. And they noted several great big spikes this year in people looking up the word xenophobia. And so based on all of those spikes, I think they noted that it was the most searched for term of the year. So based on those spikes, they said for 2016, the word of the year is xenophobia. They define it as fear or hatred of foreigners or people from different cultures or strangers, or fear or dislike of the customs of those people. So you could call xenophobia fear of the other. And if you think about the sentiments that have emerged and intensified in Europe, as we've seen this migrant crisis, you know, an influx of refugees, many of which who refuse to assimilate and who are actually committing all kinds of barbaric acts on the native populations there. You can see why xenophobia was a logical choice for the year. A lot of people are saying, does multiculturalism work, or should we embrace the other? Mm-hmm. Or is there, you know, legitimate cause for concern when we talk about trying to mix all these disparate religions and races and creeds and everything else together.
Right. So the fact that this is pretty good illustration of how these organizations figure out what these words are going to be. They see the words that people are searching for. They're looking at where people's interests are. And a lot of times it would be based on news events, maybe something that happens, somebody drops a word in a public address or something, and a lot of people go to their dictionaries. Maybe they're asking themselves, what does that word mean, or how is that spelled, or did that person use that correctly, or those types of things. And here, the fact that people kept coming back to the word xenophobia, it seems to, and I guess dictionary.com would be understandably looking at this as representative of this trend in society, that this kind of a certain amount of retreating back behind the bunker that's happening in several nations, or trying to make sense of this trend toward multiculturalism that's being exposed as problematic.
That's exactly right. People are seeing the word pop up. They want to become familiar with how to use it. And so we see that spike there. And I think it, you know, if you zoom out and look at what's happening in the world today, I think it is a great choice for the year.
So the Oxford Dictionary.
Oxford, they selected for the 2016 word of the year, they went with post-truth, a hyphenated word. and they defined that. It's an adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than our appeals to emotion and personal belief. So it's about, you know, demagoguery, kind of. Don't give us the facts. Don't burden us with all those little jots and tittles of detail. Just keep us safe, you know. People who are becoming a little fearful, becoming a little xenophobic maybe, they may begin to be more susceptible to appeals to emotion than they are to actual statistics and things like that. So post-truth.
So where have we seen this word coming up, and to whom has it been applied?
Well, Oxford Dictionaries noted several great big spikes in searches for this term. The first one came in the context of the EU referendum in the United Kingdom. You know, people voted to get out by sort of a slender margin, but I guess, in the wake of that decision, which caught a lot of people off guard. Mm-hmm. Most people expected Britain to vote Remain, but instead they voted Let's Leave. They voted for Brexit. And some people felt like that was because of emotion-driven concerns. You know, it's mostly a liberal accusation that these people who voted exit are saying that was wrong. They're not voting based on facts. They're voting based on ill-founded fears, things like that. But then there was another great big spike, of course, after the election of President Trump here in the U.S. So same thing there. They think a man like that could never have been elected if people actually wanted to make a rational, logic, fact-based decision. But because we're entering a time when apparently ill-founded fears are the deciding factor, a post-truth world, then suddenly you have this, you know, this man who circumvents facts, perhaps. I mean, that's the accusation here. And maybe that was part of the reason why there was such a spike around the U.S. election.
So it is interesting that in both of those cases, it was more of the backlash against the popular trend, probably propagated by the media. If it was appearing in a lot of articles that were analyzing what happened in Britain and what happened in the United States, it does represent, like you said, a certain liberal mindset toward those things, but there's something about the word post-truth that does seem uniquely suited to the times that we're in, that people do seem to be making more decisions and forming their opinions in very strong, heartfelt ways that are not based on truth, that it is based on false accusations and all of the emphasis on fake news and how easy and gullible people are to believe things that aren't necessarily true. And yet, even when those truths are exposed, even when they're exposed as false, then they don't want to give them up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. People seem increasingly convicted of whatever they believe, and no fact will dissuade them. That's why we see people creating these echo chambers, in a sense. Whatever the news they read, they only want it to confirm their long-held beliefs. And Oxford doesn't mention that this is also happening very much on the other side of the political aisle from those who would have voted for Brexit and who would have voted for Trump. It's also happening in large part with those who would lean more to the left. But really, whether you're talking about those who lean toward the left or the right, when people become more influenced by emotional appeals than by facts, it really means that they're more primed to embrace ideologies that are extreme. Mm-hmm. You know, they're more primed to act in ways that will deepen divides, whether you're talking about political divides, racial, religious, national. It's just if it is a post-truth age when emotion is what matters more, that's scary. It's a dangerous time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about my go-to dictionary, Merriam-Webster.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I love this one. This one really caught me off guard. It's a bit of an outlier, I think, from the other ones that came up. But for their word of the year, Merriam-Webster went with surreal, a word that comes to us from French. The sur part in French means above or over. So surreal kind of has this sense of being more real than real, like almost dreamlike in a way. But I'm sure most people have felt surreal or felt like something felt surreal after a car accident, for example. It's just this feeling of everything slows down a little and it all just feels. But anyway, the Merriam-Webster's editors noted that there were some major spikes in users looking up the word surreal, mostly after terror attacks this year, in 2016. The Brussels attacks, the Nice attack, the Orlando attack, the coup attempt in Turkey, the Brexit vote also, and then also with the U.S. election. So a lot of people are just saying, is this really the world that I live in?
Right.
How is all this happening? It feels like a movie or a bad dream.
Yeah.
So I think surreal was a very good choice for Merriam-Webster.
It does give that suggestion of just how people are trying to come to terms with events that are happening in the world and make sense of them, and they have this sense that it's all a little bit out of control or something that's not quite normal.
Exactly. That's right.
Okay, the American Dialect Society. This is nobody's go-to dictionary, but maybe you can tell us about them.
Yeah, they're a publication that they release an annual journal of some kind. I'm not as familiar with them. They're obviously lesser known than the above outfits, but I think they deserve mention because they're actually the organization that started the Word of the Year tradition almost 30 years ago. Back in 1990, the American Dialect Society was the very first ones. And they, instead of using spikes in search results like most of the others seem to do, they wait until all the other dictionaries have chosen their words and they sit down and they make a decision. They lean toward slang sometimes. But anyway, it's totally a subjective choice among their editors. And so for 2016, they selected, this is actually a multi-word vocabulary item. So instead of being a word, their pick was dumpster fire. So dumpster fire, you know, it's a kind of a slang comical noun, which just means an exceedingly disastrous or chaotic situation. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the American Dialect Society, their New Words Committee, his name is Ben Zimmer, and I think he explained the choice pretty well. He said, in pessimistic times, dumpster fire served as a darkly humorous summation of how many viewed the year's events. As 2016 unfolded, many people latched on to dumpster fire as a colorful, evocative expression to verbalize their feelings that the year was shaping up to be a catastrophic one. So it's, I mean, it does have a humorous flair. It's hyperbolic in a way, but I think it's an interesting choice just to show that some people are feeling like this year is, or that the year was a really catastrophic one.
Right. And the Twitter GIFs with, the dumpster fire with the signage underneath that says, you know, live pictures from the Republican National Convention, that type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you have anointed yourself as a committee of one to create a word of the year of your own. Maybe you can explain that.
Yes. Yeah. I actually thought about trying to send out a little poll among the editorial department and see what we could come up with. But in a pinch, I just thought that given those other words, the trumpet.com, you know, we're not a dictionary publisher. We're not lexicographers and semanticists and all that.
I think you're as close as we have to that, though.
Well, I enjoy words. That's true. But yeah. Anyway, I thought that the word primed could be a pretty apt description of 2016 in some ways, just because, you know, we're seeing this post-World War II stability that has, for 75 years now, we've had relative peace, you know, in terms of at least the global, the main powers warring against each other. But in 2016, so many pillars of that post-war peace started to develop some deep fissures. You know, we started to see all kinds of things crumble quite a bit, and it's continuing on even with more speed and intensity this year. But you could say, in light of that those pillars sort of crumbling in a way, the world seems to me like it is primed for, you know, for a conflagration to break out. It's primed for ever more division. Mm-hmm. More xenophobia, you know, more
dumpster fires,
more dumpster fires. Yeah. More post-truth. Americans are primed for more infighting under President Trump. America, we see turning more inward. And so that leaves the world open to all kinds of other people to sort of fill the vacuum that we might be vacating there. So the nations of the world really seem primed for all kinds of divides to deepen, for tensions to escalate, and just for conflict to erupt.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Just a little bit of an unusual look at the state of the world through a very specific lens. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the word of the year. He's written an article called One Last Word for 2016. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Jeremiah, you always have an interesting perspective. We appreciate you bringing that to us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
One of the great things about children is that they naturally stay away from things that are not good for them. Actually, that isn't true at all. But many parents act as though it is true. They let their kids choose their own friends indiscriminately. They give them open access to television, the internet, movies, and music of their own choosing, and so on. And many apparently think that demarking boundaries to young people impairs them, that kids are naturally entitled to all the privileges and freedoms of adulthood. Did you realize that in order to give your children all the good things you want to as a parent, you must deprive them? That's right. Young people need a firm sense of living under the protective umbrella of parental supervision and, dare I say it, control. Rather than receiving everything they desire, they need a comfortable appreciation for the word no. Consider the parenting wisdom contained in Moses' speech to ancient Israel in Deuteronomy 8. There he explained that God had orchestrated their difficult conditions in the desert for a reason. He said, "Who led you through that great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought where there was no water, who brought you forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers knew not, that he might humble you, that he might prove you to do you good at your latter end." God actually used deprivation as an important teaching tool. Now, obviously, God is a great giver, the source of all good gifts, and we ought to reflect his example in our generosity as parents. However, while God blesses us and encourages us to pursue everything that is good for us, he also outlaws everything that would harm us. And at times, for our benefit, he denies us certain comforts. He even allows us to suffer trials in order to steel our character, to humble us, and to prove us. The Israelites demanded a lot of wrong things, and to educate them as a people, God simply couldn't give them all they wanted. To give our children the right amount of the good things, helping them to see the blessings of the right way of life, yet deprive them of everything that isn't good for them, that requires true leadership in a modern parent. As our children travel a world filled with harmful things, they're going to be naturally attracted to certain of those things, and it takes leadership to tell them they're forbidden to have those things. Yet that's exactly what God does with us. To illustrate this principle, consider one vivid example: technology. Technology is a strong drug. Young people can be particularly susceptible to its evil effects. They have no built-in sense of right and wrong, no natural means of distinguishing something acceptable from something wrong. That's why it's crucial that we as parents authoritatively regulate their media usage, depriving them of wrong influences. Give your children unsupervised access to technology, that's, put bluntly, that's turning them over to some very evil influences. Even an afternoon of children's programming on public television has a lot of shady material, bad attitudes, disrespect for authority, unbridled materialism. A lot of kids' shows have scatological, gross-out humor, feminist or other politically correct messages, even demonism, witchcraft, or other pagan spiritual content. If our children watch this when we're not there, we can't counteract or stop those messages from shaping their thinking. Even the positive lessons that can be learned from certain shows, it's not going to have an impact unless we're there to reinforce those lessons. God is frank. A child left to himself brings his mother to shame. When that proverb, Proverbs 29:15, was recorded, the author couldn't have dreamed of the horrors available to a child left to himself on the internet or other of our modern media. But we as parents must be the gatekeepers of our children's minds as we train them how to be responsible for their own minds. It takes time to teach right from wrong, to help them develop the character to hit the off switch or to walk away from bad influences. So in the meantime, we need to control the off switch. Young people may know how to use a certain technology, but be unaware of the risks it poses. Particularly on the internet, certain activities can unwittingly expose our children to attack from predators. If your child has a personal web page, demand to see it. Know what pictures and music he or she is sharing, what personal information he or she is divulging. Demand that your children share their passwords with you so you can check up on them. Now, this might sound out of date. In our ultra-permissive, anti-authority world, people seem to feel their children and teens are entitled to their privacy. The truth is, we are duty-bound to invade their privacy. We have to do our best to know what our children are watching, listening to, and clicking on. But realize, of course, that our job ultimately, it's not to filter out every bad thing or to ensure that nothing objectionable enters their minds. That's impossible. But more than that, obviously, gawking over their shoulder is pretty awkward when they turn 38 years old. Our job is to teach them gradually how to make these decisions on their own. Give them the tools they need in order to walk away from something even when we're not around. Facilitate any use of technology and media that is genuinely good for our children, that builds right knowledge, cognitive development, character. But in an age of affluence and indulgence, we have to be sensitive to not stoking our children's sense of entitlement. Depriving them of luxuries will not hurt them. And any sense of unfairness or deprivation will be easily coaxed out of them if you never deprive them of the things that truly matter: time, teaching, attention, affection, love. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brad McDonald, Andrew Miller, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Benjamin Franklin: there never was a good knife made of bad steel. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.